acknowledged. Explicit rules are laid down by some of the Roman classical writers. History is full of simultaneous inventions. Yet, as is often the case, only one of the creators of natural selection is remembered as a genius. Constructing genius. When Darwin died, he was given a state funeral and buried in Westminster Abbey. When Alfred Wallace died, his life was commemorated with a small plaque, also in the Abbey. While they both discovered the theory of natural selection, Wallace is mostly forgotten. The British Natural History Museum recently struggled to raise money for a statue of Alfred Wallace, whereas Darwin is on every school child's lips. What did Darwin do to garner recognition as a genius? Part of the answer rests in what Wallace didn't do. As Darwin was racing to finish his book, Wallace continued to explore islands. Darwin published his opus in 1859, 3 years before Wallace came back from sea. The book captured the attention of the masses and began to solidify Darwin's reputation. When Wallace returned, he focused much of his time and energy on progressive politics. He was an active feminist and also evangelized against eugenics. Unfortunately, this made him lose stature among the scientific establishment, and some scientists treated him as an outsider. What's more, Wallace deferred to Darwin in a way that seems absurd in retrospect. In writing his own book about natural selection, Wallace went so far as to title his book after his rival, Darwinism, an exposition of the theory of natural selection with some of its applications. One Darwin historian later explained in an interview, he felt glad to be accepted as a partner, albeit a junior partner, in this great discovery. It seems to be more than he would have hoped for, and he was very glad to settle for it. That said, the story of Darwin and Wallace illustrates a critical point in our understanding of creativity. Genius is, perhaps surprisingly, far from an objective label. For someone to be considered a creative genius, their innovation has to be accepted by the masses. A novelist who writes a riveting book but can't get it published is not remembered by history. The modest scientist who doesn't publicize himself or herself is soon forgotten. The truth is that when people talk about creativity, they are usually talking about a creative output that is widely adopted or accepted. Think Steve Jobs or Pablo Picasso. Of course, this is different from the ability to come up with novel ideas. Put slightly differently, a person's work has to be accepted by other people to garner the creative label, and by even larger numbers of people, for a person to be labeled a creative genius. Creative genius, it turns out, is a social phenomenon, rather than simply a reflection of how innovative, forward-thinking, or influential any one person is. Anna Hill. Quote, as a teenager, I lived in the Gianicolo Hill in Rome, overlooking Michelangelo's Great Dome. During this time, my father, a redoubtable amateur art historian, made sure to point out to me the flowering of Renaissance creativity that surrounded us. I believed him, but I must confess that those masterpieces, by and large, made no impression on me. Some of them did produce an uncanny sense of serenity, others conveyed a great sense of power, or an undefinable excitement. But creativity? The great breakthroughs of Western art all looked equally old and decrepit to me. To think of them as innovations seemed a silly convention. These words echo something that perhaps we have all felt at one point, and maybe still do. Maybe as a kid you were dragged to an art museum by your parents, or as part of an ambitious field trip in middle school. You stood in front of a painting, confused. Why is this in a museum? It doesn't seem remarkable. Or perhaps you saw a work of abstract art and thought to yourself, I can do that. The author of this passage is Professor Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. He is known for his best-selling book, Flow, which popularized the notion of getting into the flow, and for his TED Talk on the topic, which has over 4 million views to date. For students of creative history, he also provides one of the most complete explanations for how things get labeled as creative. Csikszentmihalyi looks like a weathered Santa Claus who exudes not jolliness but a reassuring, zen-like quality. In fact, He could be Santa Claus's professorial cousin. In my interview with him, he explained to me the critical elements of the social phenomenon of creativity. Creativity is surprisingly hard to identify, he writes, and gives an example. An unusual African mask might seem the product of creative genius, until we realize that the same mask has been carved exactly the same way for centuries. How does something get labeled as creative? Csikszentmihalyi says three elements come together to generate this label. Element 1, subject matter. First, there is what Csikszentmihalyi calls the domain, or what I call subject matter. In most, if not all, mediums, these are the norms, practices, and previous creative outputs that are regarded as standards. For example, if we are talking about Catholicism, Csikszentmihalyi told me the subject matter would include, quote, the New Testament, the Old Testament, and the major contributions of the fathers of the church. It also includes the, quote, responsibilities that a Catholic, a Christian, would have to follow in order to be saved. Or, consider the composition of classical music. Here, the subject matter includes the musical notes themselves, examples of past successful symphonies, and the standards of composition. Any creative classical composer needs to be familiar with all of these. To create something novel, you must know what already exists. Obviously, this presents an obstacle for people who seek acknowledgement as creative individuals. First, they have to learn the standards and norms of their craft. I'll explain how they can do this in future chapters. Second, their work has to somehow become part of this formal subject matter. If you're a painter, for example, you must get into prestigious galleries, museums, and textbooks. Otherwise, your work is far less likely to be considered creative. It will be seen as merely new and/or experimental. Timing is also essential. Two paintings created in two different eras could yield wildly different results. If Andy Warhol had painted his pop art in the Italian Renaissance, he likely would have been labeled a heretic. If Leonardo da Vinci had painted a classical work during the time of pop art, he would have been seen as creating dated yet technically precise art. Interesting, but hardly creative or revolutionary. That artistic ground had already been broken hundreds of years earlier. Timing is essential to getting your work and you labeled creative. In the following chapters, I will explain how you can learn to leverage the timing of trends to your advantage. A thorough understanding of the subject matter allows anyone to understand the familiar baseline of their medium. But how do you get your work to become part of the subject matter? Element 2, gatekeepers. Csikszentmihalyi calls those who decide what constitutes the subject matter of a type of creativity the, quote, field. I use the term gatekeepers. These gatekeepers are responsible for deciding what is creative and has value and what doesn't. In art, the gatekeepers include gallery owners, art critics, and museum curators. In pop music, they are the managers, producers, and record label executives. For restaurants, it is the reviewer, other chefs, and nowadays, thanks to applications like Yelp, consumers. If you are a painter who never commands the attention of a gatekeeper, unfortunately, you are just another aspiring wannabe, not a creative genius. For better or for worse, the gatekeepers decide what has value and what will be labeled creative. For this reason, gatekeepers are a notorious challenge for creative people. Csikszentmihalyi explained to me that often as an industry gatekeeper doesn't want to, quote, creatively christen anyone new. In the world of startups, for example, venture capitalists may decide that there are too many Uber or Lyft clones already and decline to fund a new ride-sharing service. Even if a fledgling company has the potential to become a strong competitor of Uber, it may not be possible to raise the necessary capital to compete. If you cannot attract the attention of the gatekeepers, you might very well be original and technically skilled, but the truth of the matter is you will not be considered creative. As Csikszentmihalyi points out, in ancient times, a painter's standing was subject to the whims of kings and popes. Today, the group that comprises gatekeepers can be much larger, as the internet has created a more democratic, less stringent set of gatekeepers. For example, consider the world of romance novels. Kristen Ashley is one of the queens of self-publishing. She has published 57 books to date, selling over 2.5 million copies. She is one of the most prolific romance novelists in the world and is the poster child for how ebooks have transformed the genre. The romance novel has traditionally had its own set of gatekeepers, traditional book publishers, that prevented certain books from ever seeing the light of day. Inevitably, this slowed the pace of new voices and subjects. However, in 2007, Amazon launched Kindle Direct Publishing. This program made it easier for authors to self-publish, and what's more, Amazon would give them a 70% royalty on every copy sold. Almost overnight, the entire romance genre changed. Now any author could get virtual distribution. By 2013, 61% of romance book sales were from ebooks. The market had turned digital. This meant that authors like Kristen Ashley, many of whom had been snubbed by the traditional gatekeepers of publishing, could finally get their voices heard. Very suddenly, new subgenres in the romance category began bubbling up. For example, queer, lesbian, and trans romance. As Kristen Ashley explained to me, with the independent publishing rage right now, these people are also telling their own stories. There's a lot of empowerment of women going on with these books. While the internet has changed the forms of gatekeepers, there is an essential ingredient for fostering creativity: prosperity. Consumers cannot spend time attending art galleries or buying books or records if they do not have discretionary time and income. Universities and research teams need to win grants to conduct new research. Musicians need audiences that are willing to pay for music and concerts. A country's material wealth and the economic confidence of its natives is an unspoken enabler of creativity. So, creativity blossoms whenever the economy grows. The Italian Renaissance was as much a golden age of the Italian economy as it was a golden era of art, as well-heeled families such as the Medicis rose to power. It wasn't just royalty in the church that could afford to commission new art. Now traders and merchants found themselves with money to spend. Element 3, individual. The third essential element of creativity is the individual. While most of the literature on creativity focuses on the individual, no one exists in a vacuum. No matter what they do, creators first need to live in a place where the economy supports their efforts. Next, they need to know how to create projects that fit the zeitgeist. It perhaps goes without saying that they also need to create something that is technically proficient. Finally, they must successfully reach and persuade the gatekeepers of their profession to christen them as creative. According to Csikszentmihalyi, not only do individuals need to be technically talented, but they also require a set of practical attributes that allow them to engage with the media, consumers, and gatekeepers. Part of being a successful artist is being a persuasive salesperson for your own brand. You must be able to generate and capture attention. This goes against the notion of the reclusive, angry artist. Csikszentmihalyi conducted a famous study where he tested and interviewed art students, then tracked their careers over the next few years. What he found was that in school, the students who were the most highly regarded were also the ones who matched the accepted stereotype of the irreverent, neurotic genius. But in the real world of art, these students, unable to sell themselves or their wares, floundered. Notes Csikszentmihalyi, the young artists who left their mark on the world of art tended to be those who, in addition to originality, also had the ability to communicate their vision to the public, often resorting to public relations tactics that would have been abhorrent in the pure atmosphere of the art school. Personal resources can also play a large, unseen role in one's success. If you have access to private education, you'll have a far greater chance of getting into a great university with access to future gatekeepers. If your family has money to pay for violin lessons, there's a much higher likelihood that you can become a world-class violin player. Early lessons could give you years to develop an interest and skill as well as an advantage over other students, which would only compound over time. The individual also has to be accepted within the system. If you are an outsider or are marginalized in some way, it is traditionally more difficult to gain access to gatekeepers. Csikszentmihalyi found that during their school years, women and men had the same degree of creative potential. But 20 years later, when he followed up on his original study, not one of the women had become well known, whereas numerous male study subjects had gained both stature and celebrity. As Csikszentmihalyi wrote, "Until quite recently, the majority of scientific advances were made by men who had the means and the leisure. Clergymen like Copernicus, tax collectors like Lavoisier, or physicians like Galvani. Men who could afford to build their own laboratories and concentrate on their thoughts. The result is that when you study the history of creative geniuses, you find people who had the opportunity to learn the right skills, the time to master those skills, and the ability to persuade others that their work had value. This helps pave the way for the gatekeepers to accept the work of these aspiring geniuses and add it to the established subject matter or canon, which the mainstream population then looks to as the definition of what should be deemed creative. All these elements, the subject matter, the gatekeepers, and the individual, have to align for an individual or work to merit the label creative." Csikszentmihalyi summed it up in his writing. "Originality, freshness of perceptions, divergent thinking ability are all well and good in their own right as desirable personal traits. But without some form of public recognition, they do not constitute creativity and certainly not genius." This is all a roundabout way of reminding us that creativity and genius are social phenomena. As we've learned with the right training, most people can learn the technical skills that are needed to create high-quality work, as Jonathan Hardesty did. Yet training alone will not make a person's work, quote, creative, and will not admit them to the pantheon of artists. People must also receive public recognition, and crucial to that recognition is timing. You need to be producing or creating work at the moment when both resources exist and gatekeepers are interested. So, in addition to honing your salesmanship skills and maneuvering yourself into an environment that supports your creative field, you need to have the right idea at the right time. If Paul McCartney had written Yesterday in 1885, one has to wonder whether anyone would have cared. Yesterday would have come across as too different. If J.K. Rowling had written Harry Potter in 1650, no one would have read it, and she may have been burned at the stake. If timing is essential, can we learn how to master that? Is there a way to engage in purposeful practice to improve our timing? Surprisingly, the answer is yes. Chapter 6, The Creative Curve. Think of the most famous person you know of named Lisa. Who did you think of? Lisa Marie Presley? Lisa Kudrow from Friends? Lisa Bonet from The Cosby Show? Maybe the comedian Lisa Lampanelli? I've asked this question to audiences ranging from teenagers to Fortune 500 executives, and I usually get one of the above answers. Lisa from The Simpsons doesn't count. All the Lisas I mentioned share one trait. They were born in the 1960s. According to the Social Security Administration, Lisa was the number one name for newborn girls in the United States throughout most of the 1960s. Suddenly, it seemed that every parent of a new baby girl was calling their sweet bundle of joy Lisa. As the decades passed, Lisa lost favor. By 2016, Lisa had dropped to 833rd on the name popularity list. That year, only 342 newborn girls in the entire United States were named Lisa. The New York Times Magazine even ran an article entitled, "Where Have All the Lisas Gone?" This phenomenon is not particular to Lisa. Research, in fact, shows there's often a bell-shaped curve to describe the popularity of a given name, one that illustrates when names first come into favor, reach a peak of popularity, and tumble to relative obscurity. Why is it that things, and not just names, fall in and out of style? Feeling exposed. During World War II, Robert Zajonc escaped from a German labor camp. Recaptured, he was sent to a prison in France, where he escaped again and joined the French resistance. But this is less a story of a famous escape artist than it is a narrative about one of the world's most revered social psychologists. After the war, and armed with a well-deserved sense of confidence, Zajonc decided to study psychology. He ended up earning his PhD at the University of Michigan and devoted the rest of his life working to understand what drives human behavior, publishing many foundational studies on the topic. One critical experiment Zajonc conducted was in 1968 at the University of Michigan. He recruited students and told them they'd be participating in a language learning experiment. But this was just a cover for his true intentions. He began by showing the students fake Chinese characters that he claimed signified various adjectives. Next, he proceeded to show each character to his study subjects at various frequencies. Some characters he kept to himself, and others he showed as many as 25 times. Finally, Zajonc asked each volunteer to guess how positive or negative the definition of each adjective was. That is, did it represent a good trait or a bad trait, and how much they liked it. Keep in mind that the Chinese characters Zajonc was showing his study subjects had no meaning whatsoever. They were made up. But what Zajonc found would have a seismic impact on our understanding of people's tastes and preferences. He discovered there was a near seamless linear relationship between familiarity and how positive people thought something was and how much they liked it. The more often someone had seen a fake Chinese character, the more they preferred it. In other words, mere exposure to one of the Chinese characters made the respondents in the study perceive it more positively. Zajonc later called this phenomenon the mere exposure effect. His findings have since been well documented across a wide variety of fields, ranging from nonsense words, yes, this is the actual academic term, to art and advertising. The more familiar something is, the more we like it. If seeing something more makes you like it more, how can we use that to create hits? I'll explore that further in the pages ahead, but first, I want to understand the why behind the mere exposure effect. Why does this vivid pattern occur? To answer this, I talked to a researcher at the University of Virginia who studied the mere exposure effect in a more serious context, racism. The learning potential of racism. Racism often seems like an unsolvable problem. The United States fought a bloody war over slavery, and nearly a century later, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, marched in the 1960s in protest against institutionalized racism. Yet today, racism is still part of the global dialogue. From structural racism to implicit bias to explicit prejudice, societies all across the globe have been unable to rid the world of racism. What if neuroscience could, if not help reduce racism, then at least help us understand it? Researchers Leslie Zebrowitz and Yi Zhang at Brandeis University wanted to understand whether Zajonc's mere exposure effect could be used against race-based biases. What would happen if they showed respondents the faces from other ethnicities over and over? As part of their study, they decided to focus on the orbitofrontal cortex, which is tied to the reward system of our brains. It drives two different reflexes that help our brains assess a situation before we take action. Specifically, the orbitofrontal cortex's role is to tell us whether we're better off approaching or avoiding a person, place, or thing. Consider first the approach reflex, which can be measured by observing activity in our brain's medial orbitofrontal cortex. When this area of the brain is activated, your motor system eggs you on to engage with someone or something. As Dr. Zhang put it, in a gambling setting, if you start to win money, the medial orbitofrontal is where it activates the most because it registers positive rewards. Next, consider the avoidance reflex, which scientists measure by observing activation of the lateral orbitofrontal cortex. When this region is activated, Our brains tell our bodies to run away to avoid the possibility of a negative outcome. The stronger the activation, the more pronounced the feeling. Still using the gambling example, Dr. Zhang explains, when you start to lose money, the lateral orbitofrontal is the region that activates more because that's when you feel bad about the situation. Still, the question remains, how does the mirror exposure effect work? As we are exposed to something over and over again, does our approach reflex increase, or does your avoidance reflex decrease? Or as Dr. Zhang puts it, is it because we start to feel better about those stimuli, or is it that we start to feel less bad about them? To find out, Dr. Zhang and her team conduct an fMRI study of 16 white men and 16 white women. An fMRI machine is different from an MRI machine, as the former lets the scientists see the changing activations in the brain by measuring blood flow. It can show where activations are happening, while traditional MRI shows only the size of the various parts of the brain. Each participant was exposed to pictures drawn from a collection of black faces, Korean faces, written Chinese characters, and random shapes. These pictures were shown different numbers of times to the study participants, with some pictures never shown and others shown many times. Next, the researchers put each participant into the fMRI machine and exposed them to 40 images they'd never seen before and 20 they had. The idea was to see how and where the brain would react. What the scientists found was that for the images the participants hadn't seen before, the unfamiliar ones, the avoidance reflex in their brains was activated. Simply put, people were afraid of the unknown. More than just for faces, this same effect occurred when respondents were exposed to unfamiliar shapes and Chinese characters. It seems that humans have evolved to fear the unknown because it signals potential harm. If an early caveman spotted an unfamiliar species of red lizard under a bush in the forest, they might have been tempted to eat it. But over the millennia, evolution has primed our brains to signal avoidance, as that same lizard could in fact be lethal. Today, the sight of an unknown lizard triggers our avoidance reflex and makes us want to race back to camp rather than eat the red reptile. However, simple familiarity reduces this avoidance. Consider that the study's subject's avoidance reflex was significantly reduced when they were exposed to the same faces, shapes, and characters they'd seen before going into the fMRI machine. The more we're exposed to something, the less we fear it. Dr. Zhang also observed another surprising effect. She told me, "What we found is that once our participants have been exposed to a prototypical Korean face, they start to show less adverse reactions to other faces in the same racial category. Familiarity was actually able to reduce race-based biases. So, what about the approach reflex? Interestingly, with increased familiarity, it neither changed nor increased. Familiarity does not make us like things more, rather it makes us fear things less. This is one reason why we typically enjoy our own home. People and objects that are familiar feel safe. We may not particularly like that old chair we inherited from our grandmother. It's not that great to sit in and it clearly needs to be reupholstered, but it gives us comfort to have it around. Back to an earlier point though, if it's true that familiarity breeds comfort, why did the name Lisa lose popularity over time? Why wouldn't more and more parents name their daughters Lisa until one day we all woke up living in Lisaland? Love kills slowly. Don Ed Hardy was a tattoo artist who for years was best known for the Japanese-inspired designs he inked on bodies at Tattoo City, the San Francisco studio he opened in 1977. One day, he got a call from Christian Audier, the businessman behind the trendy Von Dutch clothing brand. Audier had seen one of Hardy's designs and wanted to take it mainstream. He asked Hardy about signing a license to build a brand around his art. Hardy researched Audier and, as he later told one interviewer, This guy is at ground zero of everything that's wrong with contemporary civilization. Nonetheless, the desire for greater exposure won out. I just wanted to get paid and to be left alone. In short order, Audier got the master license of Hardy's artwork and brand. Audier embarked on a deliberate strategy of getting celebrities to wear the new Ed Hardy brand of clothing. He wanted the brand to become the epitome of Hollywood chic and be seen by all. This particular marketing strategy led to one of the biggest fads of the decade. In 2009, it was impossible to turn on the television without seeing a celebrity wearing a t-shirt plastered with skulls and mottos like "Death Before Dishonor" and "Love Kills Slowly." Very suddenly, Ed Hardy was a household name. That same year, the Ed Hardy brand sold $700 million in clothing and accessories. Familiarity had created a fortune. The novelty bonus. Have you ever noticed that when the new iPhone comes out, the old one suddenly seems less attractive? If you are more comfortable with things that are familiar, why would this be? Shouldn't everyone be carrying vintage iPhones from 2008 or pink Motorola Razr flip phones from 2004? Another study conducted by Zionk provides the answer. Zionk teamed up with several other researchers to investigate how his mirror exposure theory works in the art world. As people see a painting multiple times, will they continue to like it more the same way Zionk's original respondents did when exposed to fake Chinese adjectives? First, imagine you saw an abstract painting as you made your way through an art museum. Now, imagine you had to walk by it five more times. Do you think seeing it repeatedly would change your opinions of the work? What if you saw it 10 times, 25 times? Seeking an answer to this question, the researchers showed reproductions of different paintings to students either 0, 1, 2, 5, 10, or 25 times. The students were asked to pay the closest possible attention to the paintings. Afterward, they had to rate each painting on a 7-point scale from "I dislike it" to "I like it." If you recall Zionk's original study, you might expect that with every additional view, the preferences of study subjects would increase as they unconsciously grew to fear the painting less. Instead, the paintings that the students had seen 25 times were about 15% less liked than the ones subjects were seeing for the first time. In short, the students preferred the novel paintings more than the ones that were familiar. In this case, exposure reduced their liking for the paintings. This goes against the previous Zionk study. In this newer study, novelty was preferred to familiarity. Why were the results different? To understand this, one first has to delve into the role of the brain neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine is one of the most misunderstood and, frankly, overhyped chemicals in the brain. Avid readers of pop psychology books or any books sold in airports have undoubtedly heard mention of dopamine, as it is generally portrayed as the pleasure neurotransmitter. Countless keynote speakers have suggested companies need to trigger dopamine in their customers' brains to drive gratification and addiction. But this view of dopamine isn't strictly true. In contrast to what the popular media might have us believe, dopamine plays a much more nuanced role in the human brain. To find out more, I called Emre Düzel, a neuroscientist at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London, known for his study of motivation. Düzel explained why the popular notion of dopamine makes no sense. You can prevent dopamine activity in someone's brain, and they will still find pleasure in things. When researchers block the dopamine receptors of drug addicts, the addicts still consume, enjoy, and crave drugs. So, what's really going on? He explained to me, dopamine is not so much about the pleasure of consuming something. It's about the motivation to obtain something that's signaled by dopamine. The actual role of dopamine in our brains, he says, is to determine when we should approach something to learn more about it. Duzel explained that dopamine signals to our motor system that we have to do something, and only then does it trigger the learning process. Dopamine, in short, is not the pleasure neurotransmitter. It is the motivation neurotransmitter. Duzel wanted to study what the role of novelty was on our brain's dopamine levels. To do this, he partnered with fellow British researcher Nico Bunzek for a multi-step experiment. First, Duzel and Bunzek showed volunteers a series of photos of people's faces. The volunteers then went inside an fMRI machine where they were exposed to even more pictures, including images they'd seen before, mixed with novel, never-before-seen images. Bunzek and Duzel next measured the responses in the motivation center of respondents' brains, known as the midbrain, which plays a significant role in determining dopamine levels. The more the motivation center of our brain is activated, the higher our dopamine levels, and the more motivated we are to explore and learn. What Bunzek and Duzel found was that novelty activated the brain's motivation centers. Novelty releases dopamine and encourages us to pay attention and find out more about what's in front of us. Why? Imagine that you're a prehistoric cave dweller who comes across a field you've never seen before. It would benefit you from an evolutionary perspective to be motivated enough to explore this unfamiliar territory, as it could be a new source of food. Scientists call this a novelty bonus, and it's why we pursue and enjoy novel things, whether it's a new car, phone, or food. Thus, the activation is the brain's reaction to the potential rewards that may or may not exist whenever we confront novel situations and objects. But now we're faced with an obvious contradiction. We are motivated by novelty and also fearful of the unfamiliar. How then do we balance our interest with our apprehension? Part of the answer can be found by visiting a psychology lab in Canada. There, a team of researchers decided to see what happened when people were forced to listen to the same song over and over. The creative curve. Researchers at the University of Toronto and the University of Montreal were curious to understand how the contradictory fear of the unknown and the pursuit of novelty worked in music. Does the mere exposure effect exist when we sit down and listen to a song? Professor Glenn Schellenberg, the team's lead researcher, explained to me why, prior to this study, he thought it might. Often you hear something, and it's only in the second or third listening where you say, "Oh, I like that song." He also wanted to figure out what role novelty and overfamiliarity play in our love of or aversion to a piece of music, especially the latter. He said, "We were interested in being able to document another phenomenon, the one that people get really sick of music after they've overheard it, you know, like the Macarena or, I guess, Hotline Bling." Put more bluntly, why do we learn to love certain songs and get sick and tired of others? In an attempt to answer this question, Schellenberg and his team place 108 undergraduate students in a soundproof booth alongside a computer and a pair of headphones. The team then played the students half a dozen song clips. The team didn't just use each clip once. They played two clips 32 times, another two clips 8 times, and the last two clips twice. Afterward, the students were asked to rate how much they liked each clip and also weighed in on various clips they'd never heard before. If you believe that our brains pursue novelty at all times, you would also expect that every time students heard a song, they would like it less and less. At the same time, if you believe that people fear the unknown and crave what's familiar, this means that every time students heard the song, they should have loved it more and more. But neither happened. When listening intently to the music, the students' enjoyment of the music followed a bell-shaped curve. From the second to the eighth time they were exposed to each song, the students reported liking it more, from the 8th time to the 32nd time, they liked the song less every time they heard it. Similar to the results of Zion's painting experiment, by the final time they heard a song, they actually liked the song noticeably less than they did when they first heard it. It turns out that the human pursuit of both familiarity and novelty results in a bell-shaped curve relationship between preference and familiarity. We like songs more and more with each additional exposure until they reach a peak, at which point they become overexposed. From that point on, each additional listen makes us like them less and less. I call this bell-shaped curve the creative curve. The creative curve describes a personal phenomenon tied to one person's familiarity. So, what happens when an entire population of people is exposed to a particular song, movie, or product? This is where the study of trends becomes important. A dose of reality. Don and Hardy found out about the power of trends the hard way. He told the New York Post that at the peak of his brand's popularity, quote, "It got surreal. I would go into a store to get a magazine and see an Ed Hardy lighter. At one point, there were 70 sublicensees." After 2009, however, the popularity of Ed Hardy clothing plummeted. Suddenly, Ed Hardy shirts were a gaudy cliche. Don Ed Hardy believes that the reality star John Gosselin's obsession with wearing the brand on the show John and Kate Plus 8 was the final blow. He said in an interview, "That's what tanked it. Macy's used to have a huge window display with Ed Hardy, and it filtered down, and that's why Macy's dropped the brand." By 2016, the brand was gasping for air. How did a brand climb as high as it did, then tumble so far down? Google provides researchers with a tool that shows the number of people who search for a particular phrase over time. It's a good way to observe and time some of the countries and the world's most popular trends. What happens when we plug in the words Ed Hardy? Beginning in 2005 and peaking in 2009, the brand underwent a dazzling rise. Then it all came crashing down. It's another bell-shaped curve. It turns out that while the creative curve maps an individual's preference, it also shows group-level effects. As various people are exposed independently to something at different rates, overall, the group at large, the masses, reflects the same behavior. For example, in clothing, fashionistas see brands earlier than mainstream people, but they also tire of them earlier. The result is that around the same time a mainstream individual is just starting to get interested in Ed Hardy, the so-called hip people are already tired of it. The Ed Hardy brand, along with the name Lisa and countless other phenomena, became so popular that it reached what I call the point of cliche. Where novelty-seeking peters out at a group level, the brand in question becomes overexposed and overfamiliar, and each additional exposure reduces a group's overall interest in the product, idea, or concept. Understanding both the creative curve and the point of cliche is critical to knowing how to achieve mainstream success. You want ideas that are familiar enough to increase the chances of widespread adoption and that at the same time create enough of a novelty bonus to drive interest. Think back to the Froyo craze that peaked in 2011. Froyo was similar to ice cream, both visually and texture-wise, and therefore familiar. But it was also tart-tasting and supposedly healthier for you than ice cream, making it novel and different. Consider, too, the popularity of the sushi burrito trend. Those are enormous sushi rolls that you can eat with your hands that appeared coast to coast. Sushi is familiar to many, and the sushi burrito was simply a novel twist on something we already recognize. This and other ideas are successful because they're rooted in what we already know, but intriguing enough to stimulate our brain's approach region. Thanks to the widespread cultural belief in the inspiration theory of creativity, many people believe that the key to popularity is to come up with innovative, radically novel ideas. The problem is, this can result in ideas that are too far to the left of the creative curve. These ideas aren't well-timed. They are too new, too different. They're not familiar enough. A novelist risks ending up with a book that no one likes, a songwriter with a melody everyone hates, and a startup with no users. In the best case, you're Herman Melville writing Moby Dick, a work that failed to resonate with readers until decades after the author's death. In the worst case, you spend years creating something radically innovative that almost no one is interested in. A good novel needs more than novelty. It also needs familiarity. This is true across all types of creativity. Andre Bishop is the producing artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater and, to date, the recipient of 15 Tony Awards. Vanity Fair has called him the, quote, perfect gentleman of New York theater. He and I met in his office off the labyrinthine hallways concealed within the Lincoln Center complex. Bishop looks like a man who wears a suit to any and all functions. He's dapper in the most traditional sense of the word. He explains how timing is essential in theater. Certain plays and musicals hit the zeitgeist at the moment. He gives an example. I think a show like Hamilton, especially when it first arrived, hit the zeitgeist of what was going on, especially in New York. That simply wouldn't have happened 15 years ago. This doesn't mean that Hamilton's success comes down only to timing. Bishop explains that a good play or musical also must be, quote, written by a first-rate writer, directed by a first-rate director, beautifully cast with excellent actors, and scenery that fulfills the aim of the play. Key to understanding commercial success, then, is understanding the nuances of the creative curve. Good execution is necessary, but it's not enough. Success requires that any creative work resonate with today's audience. Otherwise, you will wait for an audience that may never appear. When less is more. In early 2004, a social network was launched at an Ivy League university. Created by students, it was among the first social networks to use people's real names. It spread like a contagion. Seeing the potential, the team took a leave of absence from their studies to focus full-time on the startup. But this is not the story of Facebook. It's the story of Campus Network. A social network launched at Columbia University mere weeks before Facebook became a phenomenon at Harvard. Campus Network was co-founded by Adam Goldberg, the class president of the School of Engineering, and Wayne Ting, the class president of Columbia College. Not only was Campus Network launched a few weeks earlier than Facebook, it was also dramatically more advanced. The original version of Facebook was little more than a virtual directory, complete with pages devoted to basic profiles, friends, and poking. Many of the features that would eventually make Facebook a media disruptor, such as photo sharing, the wall, and the activity feed, came much later. Campus Network not only started with photo sharing and a wall where members could comment on their friends' profiles, its activity feed made it possible for anyone to see what was happening across the entire network, just like Facebook's future newsfeed feature. After going live in the spring of 2004, Goldberg and Ting moved to Montreal to work full-time on Campus Network, while the Facebook team moved to Silicon Valley to do the same. In the fall, the Campus Network team embarked on an all-out war against Facebook, launching the site in other Ivy League schools while also making forays into Big 12 schools, which at that point had never heard of Facebook. Along the way, school papers picked up on and began devoting articles to the rivalry. Once Campus Network launched at Stanford University, Stanford Daily asked one student, Eva Colin, about the differences between the two. Facebook, Colin replied, was inferior. Quote, there is no community whatsoever. It's more like a classified section. You can build relationships and express your personality on Campus Network, whereas Facebook only allows you to add friends and stalk crushes. But for all its advanced features, Campus Network stalled and ultimately failed. outside of Columbia University, Goldberg and Ting weren't able to compete seriously against Facebook anywhere. Eventually, feeling defeated, Ting returned to school in the spring of 2005, and Goldberg joined him the following semester. Why did Campus Network flop? Why aren't the names of Adam Goldberg and Wayne Ting emblazoned in the public consciousness? If the site offered more advanced features from the start, ones I might add that later contributed to Facebook's enormous success, why did they not work for Campus Network? It comes back to the creative curve. Wayne Ting's startup experience gave him valuable perspective on how consumers welcome or dismiss new ideas. Looking back, Ting now realizes that the sheer density of features contained in his app, which he assumed would leapfrog Campus Network over Facebook, was actually a core reason it failed. How, though? Ting told me that at the time, people held radically different views about digital identity and privacy. In the early 2000s, we still used pseudonyms and non-descriptive usernames online. Campus Network asked users not only to put aside pseudonyms and use their real names, but also to share photos and updates with their network. Ting told me, we were asking them to make too many leaps at once. Facebook, by contrast, added more features in a gradual way as users became more and more comfortable sharing information online. David Kirkpatrick, a technology journalist and the author of The Facebook Effect, remembers how barren early Facebook was. It was essentially nothing other than a place to put a profile and to connect with other people. Ting once told a BBC interviewer, what Facebook did that was incredibly smart was to hook them with the friending and the poking, and then they learned with their users and added functionality slowly over time as users became more comfortable. In essence, without necessarily being aware of what they were doing, Mark Zuckerberg and his Facebook team were following the creative curve. They were balancing the familiar with the novel. Something too novel risks scaring people off, whereas something too familiar wouldn't drive any interest. In David Kirkpatrick's book, The Facebook Effect, Zuckerberg is quoted as telling the author that the trick isn't adding stuff, it's taking away. Campus Network co-founder Adam Goldberg agreed. Facebook trained their audience to use the site very slowly without being overwhelming. Over the next few years, Facebook slowly rolled out more and more public social features. Occasionally, there was pushback in response to a new launch. For example, when the site rolled out its newsfeed. The new feature shared users' Facebook activity with their entire social network. The public nature of this caused a public relations backlash, but Facebook persisted. In fact, Facebook had a secret ingredient that helped them master the creative curve. Data. As David Kirkpatrick explained to me, users may have been complaining about the newsfeed, but they were complaining about it on the newsfeed. He said, time and again, they would see the usage data contradicted what users said. They might protest a new feature, but they used it. Matt Kohler, one of Facebook's first five employees and later a VP of product management there, explained during a lecture at Stanford in 2008 that one of the unique things about Facebook has been that audience usage went up year after year. Usually, consumer startups shed users over time as they become less novel. But Facebook's usage metrics consistently increased, in part because Facebook pushed new features that were at the right point of the creative curve. These innovations were familiar enough to feel comfortable, but at the same time novel enough to pique continued interest and encourage user engagement. Looking back on the experience, Ting feels mixed emotions. He told me, I think it's really hard not to look at this with some amount of regret and maybe some amount of jealousy. How often do you get brushed by a billion-dollar idea? On the other hand, he and Goldberg also feel a lot of pride. Ting continued, even if you are just a minor bit player in the history of social networking, we played a part. What would have happened if Campus Network had launched its app with fewer features. After all, it had a head start, a smart Ivy League team, and a determination to grow. It's hard to answer that question, but we do know this much. Campus Network didn't altogether understand what its audience wanted. It didn't grasp the creative curve. Being able to balance familiarity and novelty isn't just useful for creating fortunes, it is essential. Getting fluent. The question is, how and why did users eventually come to accept Facebook's modules? Why did the exact same features that sank Campus Network later help turn Facebook into the juggernaut it is today? You can break it down like this. As we discussed, when we first come face to face with something novel, a book, a TV show, an app, a radically new antiperspirant, both the approach and the avoidance reflexes are activated in our brains. The unfamiliar makes us fearful. It may well harm us. But our desire to explore and learn about new things is also triggered at the very same time. When most of us experience something new, for the first few encounters, our avoidance reflex runs away, overwhelms our desire to approach. Check this out. The result for most of us is that we back away, the goal being to protect ourselves from whatever that new thing is. This means an idea that is too novel has a much harder time appealing to a broad audience. It may well appeal to fringe communities, think hipsters in Williamsburg or goths in suburban malls, but the mass population of suburban parents won't go near it. Over time, our avoidance reflex is activated less and less often as we learn that the new thing won't harm us. At this point, the novelty bonus begins to outweigh our avoidance reflex. Our fear begins to dissipate. We start wondering if this new thing or experience could potentially be useful or valuable. Once this happens, we start to express liking that thing increasingly every single time we see or experience it. This upward slope is what I call the sweet spot of the creative curve. Ideas in this region of the curve are familiar enough to be comfortable, yet novel enough to compel our ongoing attention. Eventually, as the novelty bonus deteriorates, we become less and less interested in what's in front of us. After all, we can no longer gain a potential big reward. As Dr. Duzel, who carried out the dopamine experiment, explained to me, once you learn about an environment and it becomes familiar, then the novelty bonus decays over time, which is another way of saying that it reaches the point of cliché. Is there life after the point of cliché? Yes, but it's the equivalent of the dark side of the moon. After reaching the point of cliché, many ideas become what I call a follow-on failure. If you opened a cupcake shop in 2015, soon after the cupcake craze had peaked, yes, you might have had one busy year, but very likely you will soon experience a sudden drop in popularity, if you haven't already. Finally, once an idea is out of date and no longer popular, it is nonsensical to pursue it. If you opened a store devoted to disco in early 2018, you may well have attracted a tiny audience of cultural laggards, but nothing more. The individuals who ultimately become known as creative geniuses know to abandon ideas long before they ever reach this point. It's worth noting that the creative curve shouldn't be mistaken for another famous curve, the technology adoption cycle. In this model, as time passes, technology goes from 0% adoption to 100%. There are two fundamental differences between the two. For one thing, the creative curve is based on exposure rather than on time. Second, creative ideas start as unpopular, become successful, then end up unpopular again. Seldom, if ever, do creative ideas remain at high popularity, unlike useful technology, such as the zipper, that remains nearly universally adopted. By this point, you might be wondering, if the creative curve is able to explain how the tension between familiarity and novelty affects our preferences? How, then, are we able to account for the original Zionic experiment I wrote about earlier with the fake Chinese adjectives, where study subjects profess to like those characters more